From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Amidst the constant sounds of cheering crowds and honking vuvuzelas, the 2010 World Cup is underway in South Africa. Today on Only a Game, while Americans focus on trying to top England in their opening match this afternoon, South Africans are celebrating their 1-1 draw with Mexico and hoping the cup brings much more than good soccer to their country.
Because it's the first time we have a World Cup. It's so nice and feeling. We're going to find jobs and everything. We are so happy.
Also, the Lakers and the Celtics are tied at 2 games apiece in the NBA Finals. We'll take a quick look at that series. And basketball in the Philippines, why a country halfway around the world embraced an American game. Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The NBA Finals have come down to best 2 out of 3. The Boston Celtics made sure of that by beating the Los Angeles Lakers on Thursday night, 96-89, evening that series at 2 games apiece. After that game, in which his team had slipped behind in the fourth quarter, Lakers coach Phil Jackson gave the opposition credit for their desire.
They're pretty emotional. They had their backs against the wall tonight, and they played desperate, and they got away with it. We got back into the game, but we couldn't get the momentum back.
Coach Jackson may have been surprised that it was not Paul Pierce, Kevin Garnett, or Ray Allen who inspired Boston's fourth quarter burst. It was reserve Glenn Big Baby Davis, who scored 18 points in 22 minutes of action, all the while wondering when he'd be replaced. Asked after the game about his team's failure to contain Davis, L.A. coach Jackson seemed uncharacteristically flummoxed.
No, I don't want to talk about that.
Reporters couldn't resist asking Glenn Davis to comment on Coach Jackson's no comment.
You know, if Phil Jackson don't have no comment, then I don't have no comment.
During Thursday night's fourth quarter, Davis very effectively let his shooting and his rebounding do the talking, and after the game, he characterized himself as a beast. It seemed an appropriate tag, especially to those who had noticed that at his most effective, Davis was drooling. After the game, Celtics coach Doc Rivers said that didn't surprise him.
I've seen that action before. It's usually after we run in practice.
The Celtics will host the Lakers in Game 5 tomorrow night, after which the two teams will return to Los Angeles for Game 6 on Tuesday. In preparation for the World Cup, journalist Angelie Nyer has been traveling throughout Africa, getting a sense of the excitement being generated by the presence of the biggest festival in sport, which has never before been held on the African continent. She started her journey in the country we call the Ivory Coast.
I stepped off the plane in Abidjan and pretty much walked straight onto the field for a game between the local sides of Côte d'Ivoire and Togo. It was the beginning of a few thousand-kilometer trek across the African continent. It would take me a month and a half, and only cost me a few soccer-induced nicks and bruises. I was immediately overwhelmed by the soccer fever. Almost more impressive than what happened on the pitch was the activity on the sidelines. A block of the stadium was filled with Côte d'Ivoire's national support groups. Draped in various orange, white, and green outfits, they were a whirl of chants, rhythms, and vigorous choreography. They actually might have been working harder than the players. At least they were making a lot more noise. One of the group's founders, Emil Nahulu, told me the supporters take their jobs so seriously, they are not even allowed to watch the game taking place right in front of them. After all, they can watch the game at home later on television. What draws fans to the game is patriotism, a love for their country, says Genevieve Dobie, the president of the Elephant Mummies, an all-women support group. It was soccer, after all, that helped bring the country out of civil war. After impressive wins leading the Elephants to qualify for their first World Cup final in 2006, all-star Didier Drogba is said to have fallen to his knees and begged his countrymen to lay down their weapons. They did. Throughout the fragile peace process, over and over, the Cote d'Ivoire national team took control where their politicians failed. They brought the country together by winning top games not just in Abidjan, but also in Bouaké, the capital of the country's north, which was once opposition-held territory. But things have stagnated lately. The government has been promising elections for years, and even the elephants haven't been on their game. Most recently, they had a disappointing run in the African Cup of Nations in January, losing to Algeria in the quarterfinals. For the people on the streets, the World Cup is an opportunity for Cote d'Ivoire to set things right again, at least for a little while.
So big drums and fans will dance to the beat. Ring bells like the Catholics. So it's echo sweet, people left to right like alcoholics.
The celebration of soccer-inspired unity is a theme I experienced several times during my journey. It's also what inspired a number of artists, musicians, and even fashion designers to stage an event called Ghana Goes 2010.
Coming up next, you see I've changed my outfit. This is Nalem Clothing, and they're coming with their World Cup collection. Round of applause for Nalem Clothing, ladies and gentlemen.
The catwalk was suspended over the courtyard pool of one of Accra's upscale hotels. Local fashionista sisters Nana and Abina Sekiyama, founders of local brand Maxi Clothing, showed a number of stylish dresses and jackets in red, green, and yellow, the Ghanaian colors, a clear departure from the usual face paint and soccer jerseys that you normally see in stadiums. They hoped it would help open their line to an international market.
I know for sure that the World Cup line will get more people interested in their clothing. Because when it comes to the time for the World Cup, everybody is looking around to buy T-shirts, printed World Cup insignia. And I think sometimes people get a bit bored of that, especially if you're a fashionable type of person.
For many African entrepreneurs, musicians, or otherwise, the World Cup is the opportunity to be seen. It's one of the first times the West has turned to the continent for anything other than war stories. I couldn't have said it better than music producer Manche, who is in the audience for the event.
Hello, people coming in from other parts of the world who don't know anything about Africa will actually be blown away. You know, and it's, so it's good. It's a huge tourism drive to allow the world to come to Africa and see for yourself. It's not all horrible and it's not disease, famine, and war. You know, it's beautiful people, beautiful music, art, lovely food, and a vibrant culture.
When I arrived in Lagos, I was overwhelmed. A million interactions, a million moments blurred in my peripheral vision. I couldn't help but think Lagos was alive, a heavy, heaving organism bigger than the sum of its structures, interactions, and moments. In the city, you feel your insignificance. Whether you breathe or die, the city will keep speeding along. It was amidst this chaos that I met Sulia Youssef on an asphalt pitch juggling a soccer ball. Soccer, she said, took away all the chaos, all the problems, and left her feeling comfortable in her own skin.
When I'm with the ball, I feel happy, I feel comfortable, I feel relaxed. I feel like I enjoy myself when I'm on the ball, I'm playing with the ball, I kick the ball.
Sulia was there as part of a street soccer program targeted at young people from vulnerable backgrounds. She started the program about 4 years ago when she was 11, but it was only after her house was demolished last October as part of a road expansion that she really started to lean on the comforts of the ball. This summer, Sulia and her peers have something to look forward to. Running on the sidelines of the World Cup in South Africa is the FIFA Football for Hope Festival, and Sulia will be the captain of the Nigerian squad. The Nigerian program director, Yomi Kuki, is hoping for a good result, but knows that for these young men and women, it's about more than winning.
Of course, we're aiming to win, but if it doesn't come, but the idea is for them to participate, to make new friends, to open new doors, to change perceptions, to change mentalities, to change stereotypes, and that we have achieved, so we're happy about that.
When I got to Cameroon, soccer fever had hit all new heights. The streets were lined with billboards showing Cameroonian Inter Milan star Samuel Eto'o reaching for greatness, ostensibly a Guinness beer. The markets were a sea of green, red, and yellow jerseys, headbands, caps, bandanas, backpacks, and pretty much anything else that could be stained, colored, or painted in the national colors. Among the decorated surfaces was the convex belly of Cameroon's mascot, Gando Piquet, whom I met at a local match. He's a larger-than-life character who cheers on the national side at every game. He also strips down to a G-string and shakes it whenever the team scores. Gando started donning the country's colors in 1998, after he had a vision of himself in the getup.
One night I was sleeping outside between Morocco and Mauritania, and I had a vision of myself in the shorts that I wear now, painted in the Cameroonian colors green, red, and yellow. I told the Cameroonians I was there, and with that, I found my path.
But beyond the drums and vuvuzelas, it was the legend of African soccer striker Roger Milla who really brought to focus what the World Cup means to the country.
It's the consecration of African football. We never used to talk about African football at the highest level, and today we're organizing the World Cup in Africa. It shows that in the last 50 years since independence, the African continent has worked and progressed a great deal.
I landed in Johannesburg with days to go before the World Cup, and the atmosphere is electric. South African jerseys are out in the scores, and large crowds of them spontaneously break out into the Diski dance, a kind of coordinated line dance infused with football moves. And then there are the vuvuzelas, long plastic horns ostensibly descendant from an instrument made out of a kudu horn. They are often the first thing I hear when I wake up in the morning, and the last before bed. With the final countdown nearing, it's true that not everything is perfect. There have been problems with tickets, construction, and security. But despite the sorry side stories, I still think it's pretty remarkable that this event is taking place in a country where as little as 20 years ago, the color of your skin determined your place in society by law. Last weekend's Palayarona Festival in Soweto, Johannesburg's largest township, was infused with a fervor, jerseys and vuvuzelas. The carnival, ramped up for the World Cup, ventured down Vilakazi Street, a pillar of the anti-apartheid movement. Among the crowds watching were white Afrikaners, some of whom had never before set foot in a township, local Soweto mums in their house dresses, and a bunch of foreign tourists. White, black, and every shade between. The diversity is what Esther Nyebe from the neighborhood loved most.
Yes, all over. It's happening.
Is it a good thing for the country?
Yes, because it's the first time we have a World Cup. It's so nice and we feel it. Gonna find jobs and everything. We are going forward. We are looking forward. We are so happy.
For Only a Game, I'm Angelie Nyer in Johannesburg, South Africa.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. There is World Cup merchandise everywhere this year. Thus spoke Professor Joshua Bamfield of the Center for Retail Research in the UK. Dr. Bamfield was in the process of expressing no particular surprise at the appearance on the market and at the market of a jalapeno chicken sandwich that, when opened, serenades its purchaser with a version of the soccer anthem. My feeling is people want a bit of fun, the professor said, and I agree with him about that, but I can't help it. I think a singing sandwich, even when what it sings is the soccer anthem, is just stupid. Stop it. Just stop. Go away, 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 away. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, one of the nation's oldest golf courses hosts 16 young women who might be the sport's next stars. But first, I'm joined by Sports Illustrated's Grant Wall, who's in South Africa for the World Cup, which is entering day two. Grant, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
In the tournament's first game yesterday, South Africa took the lead against Mexico, which must have delighted and astonished the home crowd, but the game ended in a 1-1 draw. Is Mexico perhaps not quite as good as advertised?
There's a chance that that's the case, Bill, because Mexico had beaten Italy in its last warm-up game before the World Cup. And looked like a team that maybe could go really deep in this tournament. And, of course, they still could. But it was sort of an underwhelming performance against South Africa. Really had to scratch and claw for Mexico just to get the equalizing goal. And in all honesty, South Africa could have had another goal late to win it. South Africa is not one of the better teams in Africa even these days. And I was slightly impressed with how they played. They had a lot of home crowd support, and I think people left the stadium here in Johannesburg pretty happy with the tie.
Game two yesterday saw France frustrated by Uruguay, despite the fact that Uruguay had to play 9 minutes plus extra time a man down. Neither team scored. Are you surprised France couldn't find a way to win that game?
You know, I'm not really surprised. France has been my pick for a long time to be one of the flops of the tournament and not to get out of the group. A team that has a tremendous amount of talent under a batty coach named Raymond Domenech, who just doesn't get anything out of his guys. I got to tell you, I've seen Uruguay in a couple of World Cups now, and I have never once come away saying that team entertained me, you know? It's sort of unfortunate, but that's the way they play, and it worked against France on Friday. And so now the group is all even after one game, everyone's time.
This has not been the best possible start for U.S. non-fans given to complaining about low-scoring ties. Can you say something encouraging about the action to come in that regard?
Well, I think we're going to see in the next few days some the top teams in the world play, Argentina, Brazil, Spain eventually. So that's going to be, I think, more fun. Those teams have pressure on them not just to win, but to win with some style. And in the first day, I think most of the teams playing were just looking for results and not so much how they were playing.
Today's most intriguing matchup, at least for most of our listeners, finds the U.S. playing England. Grant, any last-minute surprises having to do with either team?
I don't think we'll see any big surprises. I just think both teams seem pretty excited about starting the World Cup. And from my experience around the U.S. this week, they feel like they can win this game or at the very least get a tie. You know, the U.S. knows that when they are on their game, they can beat any team in the world. They beat Spain in South Africa last year. It's still the only loss Spain has had in almost 4 years. I don't think the U.S. is going to go belly up in the first game like they did against the Czechs in 2006. That 3-0 loss was just ugly.
Argentina will be in action this morning against Nigeria. Will we learn as early as this game how successfully Argentina coach Diego Maradona has organized some of the world's best players into an effective team?
Well, I think we could learn things are going badly. It'd be hard to get too much of a read on total success just because Argentina's in a group that I don't think is very difficult. Nigeria, South Korea, Greece is also in the group. I think we'll only really learn about Argentina if they start progressing farther into the tournament.
Germany, always regarded as a power in World Cup competition, play their first game tomorrow. They'll face Australia, which the U.S. beat 3-1 in a pre-tournament friendly. So, easy start for the Germans?
Maybe. You know, Australia is a team that got to the second round of the World Cup in 2006. They've got a lot of experienced players, and this is a really deep group. I could envision any of the four teams in this group making it to the second round. So if I were the Germans, I wouldn't take Australia too lightly. That said, I was not impressed much at all with the way the Australians played against the U.S. last weekend, and if that team shows up against Germany, it might get hammered.
Brazil, perhaps the most consistently entertaining soccer team on the planet, opens play on Monday against North Korea. You want to handicap that one for us?
You know, it could be an interesting game. I think every game in that group will be interesting because you've got three of the top teams in the world in Brazil, Portugal, and Ivory Coast in that group. And then you've got North Korea, which, you know, it's a very defensive-oriented team, and those other teams are going to be trying to score as many goals as possible against North Korea because goal differential could come down to being a very important tiebreaker in this tournament. Brazil has struggled in recent years against teams that really pack it in, which is what North Korea tended to do.
Which games are you most looking forward to attending over the next few days?
Well, for me, the group that has Brazil, Portugal, and Ivory Coast, just because one of those three teams is not going to get through. And I think that's unfortunate, but it also puts a lot more maybe into these first-round games, a lot more tension. The winner of the Portugal-Ivory Coast game is really going to be in the driver's seat for getting through to the second round, and the loser of that game is going to be in a really tough spot.
Is Drogba playing for Ivory Coast despite his arm?
There is a question about whether Didier Drogba will or will not play for Ivory Coast. He's certainly trying to be ready to play. Broke his arm in one of the last friendlies against Japan. Had a quick surgery on it, and probably if this wasn't the World Cup, he would be out for a little while. But he's going to try to be on the field. It would be unfortunate if the best player in Africa didn't play in the first World Cup in Africa.
Grant Wall writes about soccer for Sports Illustrated, and he joins me on Only a Game from time to time as well. Thanks, Grant.
Thanks, Bill.
The Curtis Cup is one of the most prestigious events in women's amateur golf. The tournament pits golfers from Great Britain and Ireland against players from the U.S. This week, the event has returned to the course where its founders learned the game. Only a Game's Doug Trabu reports.
In match one, from the Great Britain and Ireland team, please welcome Sally Watson from Scotland and Rachel Jennings from England.
Every 2 years, the large pool of accomplished female amateur golfers in the United States, Great Britain, and Ireland is whittled down to 16 elite players who form the teams that compete for the Curtis Cup. The U.S. and Great Britain and Ireland, or GB&I, take turns hosting the match play tournament. This year's site is the Essex County Club in Manchester-by-the-Sea, Massachusetts. Speaking at a press conference in April, event co-chair Annie Barton noted that many Curtis Cup players have gone on to professional stardom in the LPGA.
Julie Inkster, Dottie Pepper, Christy Kerr, Michelle Wee, Paula Creamer all played on Curtis Cup teams, and two of this year's players, Jennifer Song and Alexis Thompson, are actually waiting to turn pro until after this event. That's how important it is for their careers.
Per tradition, Curtis Cup team captains are former Cup players. 2010 U.S. captain Noreen Moeller grew up in Woburn, Massachusetts, and learned to appreciate the competition when she was part of the U.S. victory in 1978.
The Curtis Cup match is the highest honor for an amateur woman golfer. It's what you strive for, it's what you hope for, it's what you pray for, and you work hard on your game to be selected. I mean, it's the top eight women amateurs in the country.
When played in the U.S., the Curtis Cup is run by the United States Golf Association. The tournament is the female version of the Walker Cup and is similar to the professional men's event, the Ryder Cup. Hawaii native Stephanie Kono just finished her sophomore year at UCLA. The 20-year-old says being chosen to represent her country in the Curtis Cup was one of her dreams.
Usually you get announced as like Stephanie Kono from Honolulu, Hawaii, or like from UCLA, but to hear like representing the United States, I mean the people that the country stands for and the people of the United States. It's such an incredible feeling. It's really special.
GB&I captain Mary McKenna set a team record playing in 9 Curtis Cups between 1970 and 1986. At a press conference Thursday, she said the profile of the event has risen in the past 30 years.
It has grown huge and it's fabulous. I suppose at home we would always have had more spectators, and certain places in England and Ireland would be really kind of strong golfing communities, so you would get great coverage. In my early days over here, there wouldn't have been that much of the spectators, but now, you know, it has grown.
The Curtis Cup features 3 match play formats. In match play, teams or individuals play for the lowest score on each hole, keeping track of the number of holes won rather than total strokes. In a format called foursomes, two teammates play the same ball, alternating shots, so it helps to know your partner's game. And that shouldn't be a problem. Most of these golfers have played in the same tournaments for years. University of Denver student Kimberly Kim says the U.S. players also know many of their opponents quite well.
It's kind of funny because right now I'm friends with most of these girls on Facebook, and like when we're there it's like intense, but after it's just like, okay, we're friends again.
Kim and GBNI's Sally Watson are only 18 years old, but they're also the only players with previous Curtis Cup experience. 15-year-old twins Leona and Lisa McGuire are the youngest players to ever make a GBNI Curtis Cup team. U.S. player Alexis Thompson is also 15, but she's not exactly a rookie. Thompson set a record by qualifying for the U.S. Women's Open at the age of 12. Her 20-year-old teammate Jennifer Song says meeting some past players put the Cup's history into perspective.
All of us got a chance to meet the former Curtis Cup players, and they were mentioning like what year they were on the team, and some mentioned 1950, and I'm just like, wow, like even if you double my age, I still wouldn't be born.
The last Curtis Cup was held at St. Andrews in Scotland. While Essex County Club is just a wee lass by St. Andrews standards, it has quite a history of its own. Essex was one of the first U.S. golf courses when it opened in 1893. Legendary golf course architect Donald Ross was the club pro here, and in 1917 redesigned the original course and added the back nine. The Curtis Cup was created by Essex members Harriet and Margaret Curtis in 1932, but the club has only hosted the event once before, in 1938. Lee Herder is an Essex member. When Herder was young, Margaret Curtis taught her about the sport of golf.
And she kind of taught us rules and etiquette and just generally encouraged us all. You know, and a most unlikely looking golfer in a long sort of house dress with bobby socks hanging over her golf shoes. They were characters too, as well as remarkable women.
The Curtis sisters were pioneers in women's athletics. Harriet won the 1906 U.S. National Women's Golf Championship. In 1908, Margaret won the second of her three golf titles, and for good measure, she and a partner won the doubles title in the U.S. Open tennis tournament. Since arriving last weekend, the players have learned a lot about the Cup's traditions. 19-year-old GBNI team member Hannah Barwood says what really stood out to her were the deep bonds that players form.
Meeting all the past players has definitely been a great experience to see what they've gone on to do from playing in the Curtis Cup and how many Curtis Cups they've played themselves. It's been a great thing to see and learn a lot from them, and to see so many have kept in touch and they still come back to this event and support it. It's great.
The U.S. has won the last six Cups and leads GBNI in the series 26-6 with three ties. Play opened yesterday, and after two rounds, GBNI leads 3.5 points to 2.5. Today there will be more four-ball matches, followed by foursomes. And tomorrow, the 36th Curtis Cup will conclude with head-to-head singles matches. For Only a Game, I'm Doug Trabu.
The multi-talented Doug Trabu took some excellent photographs at the Essex County Club. You can enjoy them by visiting onlyagame.org, where you'll also find various other goodies. You're listening to Only a Game. In my conversation with Charlie Pierce last week, we discussed a cake built to resemble the Stanley Cup. Said cake was covered in fondant, with which Charlie and I were equally unfamiliar. Numbers of listeners wrote to tell us fondant is a type of icing or frosting that doesn't taste good. My favorite response came from Daisy Mathias of Holyoke, Massachusetts, who quoted Julia Child on the substance. Ms. Child wrote, "White fondant is to the pâtissier what the racket is to the tennis player." Sports. Speaking of tennis, Mark Fearnow, who hears the program on WFPL in Louisville, Kentucky, enjoyed my conversation with Mr. Tennis about the French Open. Bud Collins is hilarious, he wrote. I was stumbling around the kitchen trying to remember where I keep the coffee, and Bud tossed off that line about the two of you attending tennis matches even after you're dead. I laughed out loud. Something jarred loose in my head, and I remembered the coffee is left on the sink. Please have Bud on as much as possible. Among the listeners who agree with Charlie Pierce that baseball commissioner Bud Selig should have overruled umpire Jim Joyce's exceptionally costly bad call was Mark Fountain, another Louisville listener. He put the matter in a historical context, emailing as follows. It took a few centuries, but even the Vatican could admit that it made a mistake. Galileo was right. The Earth moved around the sun. Fact won out. Let's hope it takes the baseball establishment less time to admit that Galarraga threw a perfect game. We cannot blame an umpire for a mistake in last week's story about the English national soccer team in which Wayne Rooney was identified as the top scorer in the Premiership. He wasn't, as several listeners pointed out. Rooney finished second to Didier Drogba, who won the Golden Boot. And finally, Diane Graff, who hears the program on KCUR in Kansas City, began her email by asking, "Where is the love?" There were over 7 minutes of basketball talk and 9 regarding the English soccer team, yet less than 30 seconds about hockey's exciting Stanley Cup finals. Even NASCAR's pit crew races last week got more time than the NHL in 2 weeks combined. Let's hear more hockey. Sorry, Ms. Graff, and now the Stanley Cup playoffs are over, so no more NHL for, about 3 weeks. Speak up for the sport you think we've neglected by visiting our website, onlyagame.org, and leaving us a message. You can also reach us through the listener line at 617-353-1860, and you can contact us through our Facebook page, facebook.com/onlyagameradio, or follow us on Twitter at onlyagameradio. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Harvard University, whose Harvard Summer School offers courses for high school, college, and adult students to earn academic credit and experience Harvard campus life. summer.harvard.edu. This is NPR. Beach blanket, bingo.
Beach blanket, bingo. Attractive as a summer job on the beach might seem to be, no lad with any sense would want to be a towel boy on La Playa near Las Palmas on Gran Canaria in the Canary Islands. Anybody taking the gig might find himself having to deal with the beach towel that recently set the Guinness World Record for size. Said towel covered 2,240 meters of sand when it was recently spread across the beach near Las Palmas, an endeavor that required 50 people after 25 folks had wasted 15 days making the record-breaking blanket, upon which 1,000 people could simultaneously recline. I'm sorry, did I say wasted? I must have meant spent 15 days making the blanket, because how can your time have been wasted when you set a world record, right? I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the dependably combustible jambalaya of Philippine basketball. But first, I'm joined by the intermittently combustible Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, I saw the very tippy top of the Stanley Cup go by today.
Excellent.
Being short and all.
The end of the parade of the Zambonis, and you saw the Stanley
right.
Cup going
did,
by. That's
yes.
Magnificent. Great. Well, since we last spoke, the Chicago Blackhawks did, in fact, beat the Philadelphia Flyers to win that Stanley Cup. Happened on Wednesday night in Philadelphia. So, in the past few years, the White Sox have broken an 86-year drought to win the World Series. The Blackhawks now have won the Stanley Cup for the first time in 49 years. Can the Cubs be far behind?
Well, Bill, I think yes, they can. I think they've been. I think they specialize in being far behind, and I think they've gotten very good at it.
This Blackhawks team that just won the Cup is a young team. Their best players are 21 and 22. You're in Chicago. Are Chicagoans filled with dreams about more cup hoisting coming up in the near future?
Well, they're filled with Heilemann's old style from hoisting cups all morning. But yeah, this is a team that's going to compete for this thing for the next 5 or 6 years. The way people used to talk about the Patriots as being the ideal way to build an NFL franchise, what Rocky Wirtz, son of the endlessly petrified Bill Wirtz, did was the absolute ideal on how to build a hockey franchise. It's really the team everyone else is going to look at. So yes, they will be competitive. There will be other crowded streets in Chicago in June in the near future.
Meanwhile, the Celtics and Lakers are tied at 2 games apiece in the NBA Finals. They play again tomorrow night. Any predictions for Game 5?
No, anybody who predicts anything on the series is out of their minds. I mean, you look at the series and you've got 4 legitimate Hall of Fame players. Kobe Bryant on the Lakers and Kevin Garnett, Ray Allen, and Paul Pierce on the Celtics. And none of them have won a game yet. Derek Fisher won a game for the Lakers, and Thursday night, the Celtics bench, the second unit, Nate Robinson and Glenn Davis in particular, won the game for the Celtics.
So Glenn Davis, Hall of Famer.
Well, Glenn Davis certainly making a run at MVP of the series.
Let's just get the annual coaching merry-go-round out of the way at once, Charlie. Guy Buescher is the new coach of the Tampa Bay Lightning, Avery Johnson, the new head coach of the New Jersey Nets, and Tom Izzo may or may not be the next head coach of the Cleveland Cavaliers. Which of these developments most delights or dismays you?
Well, delights and dismays is not the question. Izzo leaving Michigan State for the possible chance of coaching LeBron James really does surprise me. I think, along with Coach Mike Krzyzewski at Duke, I thought Izzo was the one most likely to stay at his college for the rest of his career. This has to say something about LeBron James and Cleveland's ability to sign him.
The World Cup underway in South Africa is a very big deal in this country, at least by one important measure, which some regard as the only measure, which is money. ESPN and Univision are paying $100 million for the rights to 2 World Cups and 2 Women's World Cups through 2014. So, who says soccer isn't on its way up?
Well, soccer's on its way up in terms of its bank account. We'll see. I mean, it was an excellent start. The host South African team, as I am endlessly told by television commentators, the lowest-ranked host country in the history of the event, actually played Mexico to a draw. Mm-hmm. And even though Mexico probably should have had 5 goals in the first half and got cheated out of one on the first of what are going to be dozens of really bad calls in this World Cup, I think South Africa can be very proud of itself. I think you can blow your vuvuzela.
All right. It's mid-June. There should be a lot of baseball news. Why does every baseball story I read begin with the name Steven Strasburg?
Because right now, baseball's got a young player that they can put up against LeBron James and the youngsters on the Chicago Blackhawks and all the young players in the NFL, and because his debut was quite something. I mean, his 14 strikeouts in 7 innings is one that draws some attention.
The bat with which Pete Rose got his final major league hit will soon be auctioned off by a New York firm. Any truth to the rumors that Mr. Rose has already sold 11 bats purported to be the one with which he got his final hit and bet 2 more of them on quick pitch in the 7th race at River Downs?
I don't know about the last part, but I distinctly remember writing a column for the Boston Herald ridiculing Pete Rose's attempt to sell several bats he used in his historic at-bat, and I wrote that column in 1989.
There's more than 11 there.
Anybody who bids on this, I'm not kidding you. This is selling pieces of the True Cross right now.
All right, so you're a hotshot high school football player. And
absolutely.
USC comes recruiting, and you say, well, gee, I'd really like to play in a nationally televised bowl game. And the USC recruiter says,
we have this lovely cryogenic tank that you can sleep in for 2 years because we can't go to a bowl game for 2 years. The worst thing, of course, is number one, even worse than the bowl game ban is the fact that the recruiting restrictions and the roster restrictions mm-hmm. that are being placed on them, this is the kind of thing that essentially blew up the Oklahoma State program for 10 years, to name one prominent example, and the fact that Southern Cal appears to be a member of what's heading to be one of the great super conferences of all time. They're going to get left behind because of these things.
Ben Roethlisberger apologized this week for having been young and immature in his first detailed interview since a Georgia college student accused him of rape. Big Ben said he had gotten caught up in being Big Ben. So, you think Roethlisberger has aged significantly since March the 5th?
No, but it does seem like he's become schizophrenic. I mean, it's you, pal. Big Ben is you, you know? You went out of your way to go cruising the bars at some very obscure college in Georgia. You weren't young and immature. You were really stupid and predatory.
Abby Sunderland, the 16-year-old who set off in January in an attempt to become the youngest person to sail solo around the world, was feared lost and then happily found alive at sea this week. Charlie, do you suppose this will have any effect on parents who keep letting younger and younger teens sail solo around the world in search of such a fleeting record?
No, this is, I mean, there are certain people that deserve to go to parents' jail, and people who let, I don't care if the kid can do it or not. It's not that big a deal. Let them wait till they're 18 or 20 to sail around the world. The whole point is to do it, not do it when you're the youngest person. This is one of those things that shouldn't be a record. You know, this should be something that people do just for the triumph of it.
David Beckham has been a soccer star. David Beckham has been a marketing icon. David Beckham has modeled underwear as well. And now Blue Water Productions gives us David Beckham, the comic book character. So will you be following the adventures of the unmasked, non-caped Bex?
Well, you also neglected to mention he was an overpaid flop in Los Angeles, but we'll skip down on that. Everybody should have their own comic book. I think that's very good. It'll be very bad, however, because if you read the comic twice, the pages start falling out.
They fall on the floor and beat their feet.
Yes, they do. And they roll around on their feet, yeah.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He loves soccer, and he joins me at this time each week on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
According to author Rafe Bartholomew, the air in the gyms where the Pro Basketball League in the Philippines flourishes can feel like, quote, simmering molasses. No wonder, then, that Bartholomew decided it would be a good idea to spend several years in such places. As a result, he produced a book titled Pacific Rim's Beer Men Ballin' in Flip-Flops and the Philippines' Unlikely Love Affair with Basketball. Rafe Bartholomew joins me now from WNYC in New York. Rafe, welcome to Only a Game.
Hey, thank you so much, Bill. I'm really happy to be here.
As proof of the popularity of basketball in the Philippines, you write that the government is said to have rescheduled a voter registration drive because it conflicted with a telecast of an NBA Finals game. Is it the glitz of the NBA that's responsible for making basketball so popular in the Philippines?
Oh, not really, because basketball became so popular in the Philippines before the NBA had any glitz even over here on native soil. Mm-hmm. The American colonial government brought the sport there in 1910 and made it part of the phys ed curriculum in the public school system. It was starting for the islands, and the sport became so popular because at first Filipinos were really, really good at it. They were some of the best players in the world because they had this head start, and it led to a very successful run in the 1936 Olympics, a bronze medal in 1954 World Championships in basketball, and just domination in Asian basketball tournaments until the mid-60s. So it's really almost homegrown there.
Teams in the Pro League in the Philippines are allowed to employ a limited number of foreign players, and some of those players have washed out of the NBA for one reason or another. You refer to one such player, Billy Ray Bates, who starred in the Philippines during the 80s as, quote, a tragic hero. How did he earn that designation?
Billy Ray Bates is this player who seemed so blessed with basketball skills and talent and athleticism, but who seemed sort of doomed to failure. His father was a sharecropper, and he grew up without plumbing and electricity. Even though he made it to these great heights in basketball, to the NBA, and then when he eventually ended up in the Philippines, as they called him the Black Superman, he scored 54 points in his first game, had seven dunks, I think five or six three-pointers, made 17 out of 25 two-point shots. So he reached these heights, but at the same time, there was always this lurking denouement for him because he tried to stop drinking. He went to rehab, but he never really got alcohol out of his life. You know, it eventually led to the end of his Philippine career, and it eventually led to him robbing a gas station in the late 90s and spending a few years behind bars for it. When you read some of the Where Is He Now stories that local newspapers have written about him, say the Oregonian or the Willamette Week Alternate Weekly, the comments on them are filled with Filipinos writing in about how much they love Billy Ray Bates. Even if the story is about Billy Ray Bates robbed a gas station, it's like it doesn't even register. People just write in and say, we love Billy Ray Bates. He's the best I ever saw. He's amazing. He flies in the air.
You write that the Philippines Basketball Association is, quote, one of the trickiest and most unforgiving leagues in the world for visiting imports, that is, international players. Besides the heat in the gym, which it sounds like it's about 120 degrees on a good night, what makes it so bad and so hard?
Well, the intensity with which Filipinos follow basketball and how passionate they are for the game leads to these really overheated expectations. Guys like Billy Ray Bates and some of the other famous imports in the past, Bobby Parks and Norman Black, these guys average 50 points a game throughout entire seasons. So they've raised the expectations to an almost unattainable level for modern players in modern basketball. I mean, the coach of the team I followed, the Alaska Aces, said that his owners, you know, support the imports that he brings in, but they won't be happy unless he brings in Michael Jordan. I mean, that's nothing less than Jordan counts. So it's a tough place for those guys to play because the whole reason they're playing in the Philippines is because they're not Michael Jordan.
The contemporary heroic U.S. transplant whose career in the Philippines you chronicle from the bench is Rosel Roe Ellis. Tell us a little bit about his career and how he found himself playing for the Alaska Aces, which team, incidentally, has nothing to do with the Alaska that you can see from Russia.
Yeah, nothing at all to do with it. It's actually based on the Alaska Milk Corporation in the Philippines. Throughout the 80s and 90s, when they were called the Alaska Milkmen, it made a little bit more sense.
And they aren't the funniest name in the league. Give us some of the others before you answer that question.
Sure. One of the best is the Pure Foods franchise, which just recently actually changed its name to the Derby Ace Llamados, which is referring to a brand of pig and fighting cock feed. But when it played under the Pure Foods name, which was a meat canned meat company, they were the Pure Foods Chunky Giants, the Pure Foods Corned Beef Cowboys, the Pure Foods Tender Juicy Giants.
That's my favorite.
Yeah. The Pure Foods Tender Juicy Hot Dogs. They'll switch it up to promote a new product.
Yeah, but how did anybody ever beat the Juicy Giants?
The Tender Juicy Giants.
Yeah.
Actually, the Tender Juicy Giants won the most recent All-Filipino Conference Championship. No one did beat the Tender Juicy Giants.
All right. Let us get back, however, to Rosel Roe Ellis, because he's the player, really, that you spend the most time writing about in the book. Tell us a little bit about how he ended up in the Philippines and how he achieved what I read as a terrific success.
Absolutely. Well, Rosel Ellis had a sort of long, winding start to his career where he played at the same Seattle high school as guys like Nate Robinson and Jamal Crawford, who are currently in the NBA. He was the state player of the year in 1993. But he ended up going to junior college and then a small Division I school. He's a classic tweener in basketball terms, which means he's too short for his position. So he didn't get drafted and ended up playing in the minor leagues. He was starting to gain some attention from NBA scouts who thought, oh, maybe we were wrong about this guy. And then the wheels just came off. He snaps. He has a short fuse. So he snapped in a game in this IBA in 1998. He jumped on top of the referee's back and put him in a sleeper hold on TV with NBA scouts watching in the crowd. He ended up playing in places like Argentina. He played some in Indonesia, Venezuela, and the Philippines. I met him in 2007 with Alaska. And by then, he had totally turned around his reputation. You know, if after the altercation with the ref, he was thought of as a hothead or maybe this head case guy that was borderline dangerous, by the time he got to Alaska, his nickname was Mr. Everything, the guy who does everything on the court, and he was a guy that everyone wanted on their team.
If a guy who had bounced out of the NBA after a 10-day contract or two were to call you up today and say, hey, Rafe, I got an opportunity to play ball in Manila. Should I go? What would you say?
Oh, I would definitely say that he should go. Players do know, and they expect a little bit of hijinks when they go out to play in the Philippines. And sometimes they're actually very guarded and paranoid about the teams that hire them because they've heard about the league, and they've heard that, you know, these guys aren't very loyal to you in the sense that they'll replace you in a minute if they think there's a better guy or if you're not playing up to their sort of unattainable standards. But regardless of that, one, you know, these guys play for a living, and the Philippines pays well, and they pay on time. So in terms of that, the player should go there. And also, it's a rare place where you can play outside of the United States and still be part of a really vibrant basketball culture. I mean, I would say even much more vibrant than here in the States, where, you know, you're competing with other sports. In the Philippines, there's no other team sport that even is televised. So by going there, you really are going to be playing in front of a country of people who love basketball, who understand the sport, and who will cheer like crazy for you, not only when you play well in a game, but when you walk through a mall. You know, you're walking by McDonald's and people will run out and be like, "Wow, wow, you're so good." Who wouldn't want a taste of that, you know? And if it doesn't work out, then at least you get paid for it.
Rafe Bartholomew is the author of Pacific Rim's Beer Men Ballin' in Flip-Flops and the Philippines' Unlikely Love Affair with Basketball. It's published by New American Library. And the author joined me from WNYC in New York. Rafe, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Bill, thanks so much. It was really fun.
A Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trevu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Jack Flagler is our intern. We had help this week from Alistair Drummond, Doug Shugarts, Kurt Nickisch, and Adam Yofi at WBEZ in Chicago. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our photo galleries, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, or listen to archived shows and stories, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word this week comes from high school senior Jessica Korda, a golfer battling for the Curtis Cup.
I would wear red, white, and blue every day if I could.
Gee, I wonder which team she's on.
USA all the way.
Yeah, I got it, Jessica. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston, LendingTree, with the innovative Loan Coach, which provides personalized financial advice for every step of the lending process at LendingTree.com. The Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at WallaceFoundation.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at MacFound.org. This is NPR.